decision in May to go officially no contact with her. I immediately felt a weight lifted off of my shoulders. I know without a shadow of a doubt that this is the best decision for my life. I am now working with a wonderful counselor and working on healing myself. When all efforts fail at salvaging the connection or staying low contact, again, this is a highly personal choice, whether to live with a painful status quo or to push forward to break free. It's at this point that many daughters begin to consider divorcing their mothers. It's a moment filled with ambivalence and fear, as well as the hope of living differently. Thinking about divorcing mom. It's been 5 years, and I still struggle with feeling ashamed. A part of me still believes that someone better and stronger than me would have found a solution. I feel as though it's my fault somehow at moments. Of course, that's what my mother says. Sally, 51. In the court of public opinion, the daughter is always on trial. The societal response to a mother or a father who disinherits a child, whether it's someone famous like Joan Crawford, who cut two of her children out of her will, referring only obliquely to reasons that are well known to them, or your next-door neighbor, is muted and more or less accepting. Ah, yes, culture murmurs, feeling sorry for the parent, summoning thoughts of an incorrigible or impossible child, a black sheep, the one with whom you tried everything you could think of, but nothing worked. There's a collective nod, an acknowledgement that parenting is hard and that children can be difficult to deal with. In contrast, the adult child who cuts her mother out of her life is judged on the spot, labeled as ungrateful, irrational, immature, impetuous, or acting out. The myths of motherhood are largely responsible for this cultural stance and, combined with the fifth commandment, pack a mighty wallop. As a daughter who wrestled with the question of choosing no contact for 2 decades of my adult life, cutting off and then going back again and again until I finally bailed at the age of 38, I've seen people change their opinion of me in seconds. It might be a doctor or nurse asking me about my mother's health when she was my age and hearing me answer, "I don't know, she wasn't in my life." Or it could be a new acquaintance hearing that, "No, my daughter never met her grandmother, even when she was still alive and living not very far away." Yes, I have a dog in this race, and I know the cost. I have been called selfish, narcissistic, and much worse by total strangers. No one likes hearing about unloving mothers. No one. Some observations about going no contact. I have spoken to many women over the years, both before writing Mean Mothers and since, about maternal divorce. It is, in every sense of the word, a crucial decision, and I use the word deliberately because it comes from the Latin crux or cross. You are at a crossroads in life by considering this decision. In ancient times, the crossroads was a place of mystery and life-altering, signifying a major decision. This is no different. Here are 3 anecdotal observations you need to keep in mind as you think about your choices. No one sees the cutoff as a real solution. While you're unlikely to hear this from most people, the truth is that maternal divorce is a last-ditch effort to establish some normalcy. It is usually preceded by years of effort on the daughter's part to try to fix things, either on her own or with a therapist's help. Because a daughter never divorces just her mother, she inevitably will lose other family members, including siblings, aunts, uncles, and even her father, as people take sides. It is emotionally highly fraught and very painful. Ironically, maternal divorce is hard and scary precisely because the decision has to draw on self-love and self-esteem, which are usually in short supply. Sometimes, after going no contact, a daughter will try again. Alas, unless the mother is willing to go into therapy to thrash it out, it rarely works. While going no contact solves some problems, it inevitably creates new ones. The need and longing for a loving mother coexists with the cutoff. It's not unusual for adult daughters to experience a great sense of loss, even though they initiated the break. One daughter described the grief she felt as the final death of her hope that someday her mother would love her. Sometimes, the pain will outweigh the relief the daughter feels, and she'll reinitiate contact and get back on the merry-go-round for a time until she finally concludes she must divorce again. If you have found yourself in this pattern, it's important that you see it as par for the course and not indicative of any failing on your part. Be patient with yourself. The core conflict is resolved by your healing alone. I know it sounds weird, but it's true. Going no contact will not end the core conflict. The therapeutic stance toward parental divorce may be insufficient. Daughters who are in therapy may feel pushed into divorce when they're not ready, or, alternatively, feel that their decision to go no contact isn't being supported or is being actively discouraged by their counselors. My own therapist wasn't in favor of my cutting my mother out of my life, arguing that you can't ever hope to fix a relationship that you're not in. That's both logical and true. In my case, having tried for 20 years to fix things with a mother who categorically denied that anything was wrong except with me, I didn't heed her advice. There's no one-size-fits-all answer to whether maternal divorce is the right choice for an individual. It's a personal decision. Deciding on divorce or no contact. There's a terrible anguish in choosing between saving yourself and the losses that accompany divorce. One daughter recounted the terrible turmoil she felt when her therapist suggested she cut her mother out of her life, and she realized that, likely as not, she would lose her connection to her father. She talked to her father, and he suggested she take a hiatus from her mother instead of acting definitively, and reassured her that somehow they'd work something out. Nonetheless, she felt shame and conflict. I also feel like the worst person in the world for even considering cutting my mom out, especially as she is just getting older and may someday really need my help. But I know you have to take care of yourself, and sometimes that means letting go of people you wish you didn't have to let go of. So, no, I don't think my relationship with my mom can be salvaged, even though I wish it could be. Since I've never really been able to hear myself speak or even think when around her, and even when not around her because she never really granted me the opportunity to have a voice of my own, I especially don't feel that continuing a relationship with her is a good idea. She just, and I hate to admit it, but it's true, has too much power over me, as all mothers seem to have over their children. But despite not feeling like I should have a relationship with her anymore, I don't know how to cut ties with her, especially with my dad in the picture. Other daughters have transitioned from low contact to no contact over time. One woman explained why it was that she thought she was heading toward the final cutoff. I have chosen recently to go low contact with my mother. This has been very good for my family and continued healing. However, given that I am no longer a source of narcissistic supply for her, my mother has ratcheted up the drama and is constantly testing boundaries. I am actually thinking at this point that it may be best to go no contact. This is a difficult decision, but I have come to the acceptance that she is not going to change, and my family and I are better off without her. I think that any relationship can be saved and that anyone who does the difficult work can change, but I think that would be unlikely now, given her age and how entrenched her behaviors are. Again, only you can decide. Divorcing your mother isn't a solution in the traditional sense because it involves an admission of powerlessness, as Cece noted. I can't fix what she's broken. I would like a distant relationship with her and for my kids, but it's not safe, and our age of connectivity means the distance I'd be okay with isn't possible anyway. and she still smears me to others and claims our rift is a result of my brokenness, not her continued abusive behavior. As I said, I can't fix what she's broken. Maternal divorce also doesn't answer the larger problem of being unloved. In truth, going no contact is the first step in a long process which, in the best of all possible worlds, includes mourning the mother love you didn't get and so richly deserved, the growth of your own self-compassion, and the stilling of the voice within, internalized from years of criticism and verbal aggression, and replacing it with a tape that says, "You're fine." At our most optimistic, humans like to believe that all close bonds can somehow be repaired or salvaged so that we're not left with nothing. This is especially true when it comes to a relationship, that of mother and child, that our culture places on a pedestal separate from all other connections. The pity is that when the damage is severe, it can't be. Self-doubt and the worry that you're the crazy one. Most of the time I feel confident that I've made the right choice. But then there are moments when I'm imagining picking up the phone and calling her, and miracle of miracles, she's so happy I called and everything will be different. Well, I gave in to that impulse a few weeks ago after 3 years of no contact, and after enduring 15 minutes of a blistering attack in which she listed every one of my flaws and explained why I was worthless compared to my sister, who is so wonderful and fabulous, I deleted her number from my phone. I'm going to have to learn to weather those moments, but I'm not leaving anything to chance. Diane, 46. If you're wrestling with the decision to go no contact, or you've taken the step and are filled with angst, don't beat yourself up. It's a big decision, and yes, it should make you nervous. But there's the good kind of nervous, the kind of self-questioning that goes into a major decision, and the bad kind of nervous that melts you down into a puddle of self-criticism and puts the voice telling you it's all your fault on a loudspeaker. Pay attention to the difference. Keep in mind that unloved daughters, and yes, I include myself, really want to be like everyone else. And everyone else, from the daughter's point of view, is comprised of those mother-daughter pairs she sees on the street, laughing and talking, going shopping and having lunch. You know, those people who don't feel depressed on Mother's Day or Christmas, and who actually feel loved by their mothers. I bring this up because it's part of the complexity of even considering, much less implementing, a divorce from your mother. The truth is that the relationships that end in estrangement are not amped-up versions of normal stress or tension in healthy mother-daughter relationships. Stress, and even friction or real fraction, happens in basically loving mother-daughter dyads, particularly in times of transition. There's no question that the mother-daughter connection undergoes a period of transition from late adolescence to adulthood. A body of research substantiates that. As do the relationships between mother and son, father and daughter, father and son. Mothers used to an authoritarian or controlling style of parenting will certainly feel the friction the most as their daughters begin to make choices that are not necessarily the mother's own. Research shows that mothers may experience lowered subjective well-being when daughters outstrip or eclipse their mother's choices and achievements. In loving and relatively healthy relationships, boundaries are redrawn by both mother and daughter, and acceptance of a child's choices, even grudgingly offered, gets worked out. These relationships, while not perfect, what connection ever is, have a pattern of give and take, even in times of stress and difference. The unloved daughter is in a very different place. Unless her mother is willing and ready to take responsibility for her actions and words, past and present, things will stay the same. What about grandma, daughters, and their children? While I actually divorced my mother because I didn't want her to come into contact with my child, many women are ambivalent about going no contact, because they don't want to deprive their child or children of an extended family. Not surprisingly, they hold out the hope that, regardless of their mother's failures at parenting, they will somehow succeed as grandmothers, or at least be good enough. That's actually not as crazy as it sounds, because the two roles are so different. Grandmothers can send grandchildren home at the end of the day, don't have to pay their bills, and can control the degree to which they choose to interact. Sometimes it works. Often, alas, it doesn't. Anecdotally, it seems to work best when there's physical distance. The visits are short, and the daughter stays largely out of the picture. When a daughter decides to go no contact with her mother, the problem becomes more complicated. On the one hand, there's the guilt of depriving your child or children of an extended family. On the other, there's the risk that your own offspring can be manipulated to get at you in some way, even getting co-opted to your mother's side. That sounds paranoid, as all get out, but it actually does happen, as Darcy's story makes clear. My husband is an only child with only one surviving parent whom he adores, and he really doesn't understand the conflict in my family. There are four children in my family of origin, three sons whom my mother treats well, and me, the scapegoat and disappointment. Make a long story short, I gave in and allowed my kids to see their grandmother, and she filled them with poison about me. But the breaking point came when my husband realized that she was scapegoating my kids in front of my brother's children. He talked to my mother, who called our kids liars and denied it all. My husband's eyes were finally open. Anna, now 60, lived in the same town as her mother, and she felt she couldn't deprive her two daughters of their grandmother. In her case, things were peaceful until her daughters were preteens and they became increasingly uncomfortable with how their grandmother constantly criticized their mother and started telling them that they would have to take sides. She'd get angry when the girls refused to play along. Ultimately, the girls themselves decided they wanted to see less of their grandparents. On the other hand, Jane reports that she had success allowing her sons to see her mother and explains why. I set very distinct rules and boundaries and made it clear to my mother that if she badmouthed me or my husband, the boys couldn't visit her anymore. I trusted my father, too, to make sure that happened. My mother treated my brothers well. She considers girls pretty useless and I'm a good example, and I figured she would be okay around my sons. It wasn't always easy or a cakewalk, and I can't say that the boys felt close to their grandmother, although they adored their grandfather. But it mainly worked. Again, each daughter's experience, her relationship to her mother, each family constellation, makes each situation unique. Each of us has to make our own choice. Dealing with fallout and no end in sight. I am a pariah in my family, the crazy one, the mean one. My sister and brother have seen an opportunity for themselves when I went low contact with our mother and worked it to their advantage, painting me as ungrateful, impossible, and yes, a narcissist. Which is pretty ironic, given the givens. Family gatherings became even more impossible, and they waged a campaign for our mother to fire me. Ironic, because I had been back and forth in therapy on whether or not to go the final step. Long story short, she divorced me. It made it harder on me in some ways and easier in others. Margaret, 50. For some daughters, divorcing mom is the very last stop. It was for me. My relationship to my much younger brother, long uneasy, finally succumbed within a few years. With the rest of my extended family an ocean away, I was on my own with my daughter and husband. The core conflict, for me, stopped on a dime because becoming a good mother became my focus. For many, though, the pain of exclusion continues. Hearing about family gatherings but not being invited to them. Being gossiped about and then informed of the gossip, especially if they live where they grew up or are still in touch with outsiders who are connected to family members. Feeling as though they can never go home again, even back to their old neighborhood. Some still feel real shame about the choices they've made, even though they know, deep inside, it was the only choice, and they have support in their circle of intimates. But it's over, except for emotional loss and perhaps the continuation of the core conflict. That may seem like paradise compared to what happens to some whose mothers continue fighting a battle of attrition even when the daughter has opted out. These mothers continue to try to insinuate themselves into their daughters' lives by contacting other family members, their husbands, and anyone who will listen, spreading lies and creating drama. Sometimes they co-opt friends and neighbors, too. One daughter wrote to say that her mother sent her husband a birthday greeting with a gift card for his favorite restaurants, sends presents on every occasion to her daughter, and calls them both, even though the daughter has repeatedly asked her not to. It sounds crazy, but it's true. Another daughter recounted how her mother actually tried to convince her husband that she was cheating on him and offered to help bankroll the divorce. No, I'm not making this up. But you'd have a hard time getting past an editor's red pencil if you put it in a novel. Yet another recalled how, when she decided to divorce her husband, her long-estranged mother ended up colluding with him to try to take her children away. 3! She kept her kids, by the way. Daughters have even found themselves the victims of smear campaigns at work, which turn out to have been orchestrated by their mothers. And yes, there are nightmarish incidents where a daughter's children have been co-opted into their grandmother's orbit. When it does happen, it seems to take place at moments of stress in the mother-child relationships, usually the transitional periods of adolescence or young adulthood, when there's often tension in even fundamentally close connections, and the grandmother is able to insinuate herself into the mix. That's what happened to Janine. My mother started to manipulate my daughter when she was 14 by buying her things I couldn't afford, but especially the provocative, sexy clothing I didn't want her wearing. Grandma told her I was too strict, unreasonable, and became her cheerleader, all of which contributed to growing tension between me and my child. She moved out of my house at 18 and into my mother's home. Luckily for me, once my daughter moved in, my mother started treating her as she did me. She was back home in 3 months and then went off to college. Our relationship is still a work in progress, and she has limited contact with her grandmother. I have none. There's no data on the mother vendetta, but if it befalls you, please recognize that it's a form of gaslighting and a reflection of your mother's need to continue to control and manipulate you. Even though you've vacated the sandbox, it's no fun for the bully to find herself there alone. Remember that her actions are a reflection of her, not you, and represent more evidence of the toxic environment she needs to create to feel good about herself. Get professional support if you need it, and stay out of the fray as much as you can. Try not to feed into her needs. Exercising self-compassion again. Why is it so damn hard not to blame yourself? Leslie, 43. Please try to be kind to yourself as you attempt to resolve, and the word is in quotation marks for irony because there's really no resolution, your relationship to your mother. Use your goal-setting skills to figure out and make concrete what you want to do. Write it out. Don't be hard on yourself if you second-guess or worry from time to time. Important decisions require thinking through. Get help if you need it. Therapy is best, but if you can't afford it, a non-judgmental friend or intimate will do in a pinch. Give yourself time to sort out your emotions and work on labeling them so that your emotions inform your thoughts. If you are anxious about your choices, the best way to quell your anxiety is to remind yourself of the validity of your feelings and why you felt as you did. Most important, have self-compassion for the hurt little girl inside of you. It's her endless hopefulness that she can somehow make this right that makes this process so agonizing. Here are some ideas for growing your self-compassion at this stage. Recognize you're not alone. Going no contact can be a lonely place. And if you're still not convinced that your mother's treatment isn't about you, it can be a place of shame as well. I realize it's hard to confide in others, but if there are people in your life you trust, please do. Get professional support if you need it, making sure that your counselor isn't categorically against going no contact. Some are. Remember that your struggles are shared by many others. Yes, the percentage of those whose emotional needs weren't met in childhood is somewhere between 40% and 50%. So it's likely that someone you know has faced similar challenges, even though the taboo nature of the subject keeps everyone mum. Break the silence using newfound discrimination. Focus on mothering yourself. Be good to yourself by being understanding rather than self-critical. Focus on the progress you've made and use if-then thinking to tackle the moments at which you fall short of your own expectations. Spend time with people you care about and who care about you when you're feeling discouraged. Applaud yourself when you've handled something better than you used to or when you feel you've taken a stride in an important direction. At their best, mothers are their children's life coaches. Be your own. Begin the process of mourning. We'll be discussing the need to mourn the mother you deserved in the next chapter in greater detail, but this is the moment to start mourning the mother you deserved. Yes, not your actual mother, but the one absent the lottery of life you should have had. Mourning in this way can help you gain in self-compassion. It's a way of seeing that your needs were legitimate and that it wasn't because you were too sensitive, needy, or difficult, as well as bolstering your faith in your judgment as you compare the mother you had with the one you needed. Mourning the mother you wanted and deserved can also help you self-mother and provide an image for visualization when you're stressed or nervous. Look forward, not back. Letting go of the past doesn't mean denying that it happened or insisting that it really made you stronger, but it does mean setting it behind you as you move forward. Once you've decided the right way for you to manage your relationship to your mother, recognize that you've reached an important milestone by exercising your agency. If you decided to try to maintain a relationship and it's not working, don't beat yourself up. Keep in mind that the success of your efforts isn't fully in your control. Your mother will either cooperate or she won't. Staying firm and balanced. Boundaries and tolerance. I'm still struggling with feeling as though people won't like me if I assert myself. I realize that this is self-destructive because I'm the one making myself into a doormat and then get angry at others as if they made me stunt my life. I'm working on it, but it's hard. Celeste, 37. If you're going to redirect your life in meaningful ways, you will continue to have to pay attention to boundaries, both yours and those of others. Set goals for yourself to manage reactivity if you're still having trouble finding balance in your relationships, and continue to use if-then thinking to prepare yourself for moments that might be stressful or that you know will test your ability to manage your emotions. These could be situations as various as having to address a group at work, going to a gathering where you know very few people, or doing something new and unfamiliar. If you've come to realize that you're highly sensitive to abandonment, gear up before your partner or spouse goes off on a business trip, or if a friend or intimate has decided to take some time off alone to recharge. Part of setting boundaries entails being very clear about how, in this new stage of your life, you will allow others to treat you and about behaviors you simply will no longer tolerate. Again, work on being consciously aware of your responses to other people's words and actions, checking to see if you're reacting to the present or to triggers in the past. That said, deciding that you won't permit people in your life to try to marginalize or manipulate you or are verbally abusive is a perfectly healthy response and part of redirection. If you've lived your life armored and wary of others, work hard at becoming more discerning about people's intentions and motives, especially if self-isolating in this way is no longer working for you. If you want and need to have closer connections, you will also have to become more aware of how unconscious processes are driving your choices and substitute conscious awareness in the area of relationship. Partners, friends, acquaintances, finding the right ones. There's no question in my mind that I keep wandering back to where I started. Is it that I'm attracted to people who treat me as my mother did, or do manipulators see me as an easy mark? I've been more discerning of late, getting out of situations that feel familiar the minute I realize they do. That's progress. Miranda, 36. It's at this moment that what you've learned about your own style of attachment needs to be put to work, no longer theoretically, but as information you'll need to draw on as you redirect and reconfigure your relationships to others. You can set relationship goals for yourself as you would any other goal pertaining to work or life. Begin by assessing your relationships across the board, from the truly intimate ones to those that are much looser or to ties that are shallower, and see whether they are working the way you want and need them to. This isn't a decluttering exercise because the point isn't to get rid of every existing relationship and start over from scratch. That may be true for some who have managed to recreate their childhood environments, but it's not going to be the norm, although many will find a few relationships aren't salvageable and are impediments to growth. This also isn't a call to heap all the blame on others. You need to take responsibility for what you bring to the party. This is about taking a realistic inventory. Following are some strategies derived from research that may help you set relationship goals. Use abstract thinking, not specifics, when you consider what's missing in your life. Studies show that people who think abstractly about losses and lacks in their life are more likely to meet their goals than those who think in concrete terms. Let's say, for example, that an important intimate relationship has ended. Rather than thinking, I need a new lover, spouse, boyfriend, think instead about what you miss having in your life. That could be a sense of connection, mutual caring, sharing your life, or anything else. But the point is that if you think about what it is that you want in this way, you'll discover many different avenues for achieving your goal than thinking, I need a new lover, doesn't. For example, a sense of connection can be fostered by group activities. Working on a project such as community gardening, mentoring a young person, and many other pursuits. Charles S. Carver and Michael F. Shire, experts on self-regulation, note that understanding the core desire abstractly makes you far more flexible in terms of achieving your most important goals, because it allows you to see different pathways to achieving them. Strive for a more complex definition of self. Studies by Patricia Linville show that people who have defined themselves narrowly, believing that a single role defines them in a primary way, not only have more trouble dealing with the daily stressors in life, but are also less resilient and have more difficulty coping with goal-related setbacks. This makes perfect sense. If your marriage has imploded and your primary definition of self has been wife, there's a good chance you might go down for the count. If, though, your definition of self includes wife, along with friend, tennis player, volunteer, singer in the choir, mother, worker, cousin, sister, many of these other definitions of self will help to buffer you from the blow. This strikes me as doubly relevant as you move from defining yourself as an unloved daughter to a more proactive, more engaged self. Thinking about self-definition in this way will also help you forge new connections, pursue new activities, and, in the process, enrich existing relationships. This is especially true for those women who have kept their troubled relationships to their mothers a closely guarded secret, unwittingly self-isolating themselves in the process, or who have avoided close connections. Remember that attachment styles aren't set in stone. Building on the relationships you have. What you have learned about your own reactivity, triggers, and attachment style can be used to further understanding in your adult relationships as you become more adept at recognizing the attachment styles and behaviors of close others. Part of redirecting your life may include strengthening the relationships you already have and working to make those connections closer and more intimate. If then thinking is useful, if there are relationships that need repairing, since you will be forcing yourself to think about various ways you can reach out and have Plan B and Plan C in mind if your initial response isn't well received. Children, fear and joy, both are either, take your pick. The idea of having a child and becoming my mother and doing what she did to me terrified me. I married someone who didn't want children for that very reason. Now, looking back, I wonder whether I was right about myself. I am kind in ways my mother never was. I'm caring. I don't know what might have happened. Linda, 55. In the best of all worlds, the decision to have a child would be a considered one, even though we all know it isn't always. People have children for all manner of reasons, and some are better and more predictive of good parenting than others. Unloved daughters have a different kind of stake in this decision, largely driven by the fear that they will simply repeat their mother's behavior and continue the cycle for another generation. Is the fear reasonable or unreasonable? As someone who was afraid and decided not to have a child for almost 2 decades of adult life and then reversed myself, the answer isn't as clear-cut as some would like it to be. Basically, it depends on the daughter herself and the degree to which her behaviors have become conscious and aware. Since parenting is learned behavior, we're more likely to repeat learned patterns if we're not emotionally and intellectually present. For starters, it's worth looking at some pretty terrible reasons to have a child. You may recognize some people you know in the description, perhaps even your mother. To have someone who loves you. I've had a number of women, all of whom had babies very young, make this confession. In most cases, they explain that having a baby seemed to offer a respite from the pain of unloving parents or rejecting relationships with lovers or spouses. The real problem, of course, is that the burden of supplying love is shifted onto the child, who is supposed to be emotional first aid for the parent. That is a recipe for disaster. Because someone expects you to. It doesn't matter who that someone is, a parent, a spouse, or societal pressure. Having a child is a decision you need to own on every level because it is an enormous commitment. The work that good parenting requires is far too intense and demanding to be inspired by anyone's expectations other than your own. To fit in. Yes, some women actually admit that they were afraid that others would somehow shun or stigmatize them if they decided not to have a child. Perhaps they would seem less than women with children. If we are honest with ourselves about so-called cultural norms, we would recognize that this is actually a legitimate worry for many. Still, it isn't a healthy motivation to commit to parenting. To give your life purpose. While it's true that raising a child can give your life focus and purpose, it's a lousy reason to have a child. You are the only person who can define what gives your life meaning. It's not an obligation that can be fulfilled by another human being, not even one you give birth to. This reason, and the next, can easily become enmeshment, which involves denying the child the room she needs to become herself and totally ignoring her emotional boundaries or micromanagement. A child's job isn't to make your life look better or richer than it actually is. To establish your legacy. Historically, dynasty, the protection of material goods and assets, and a need to leave something behind in the wake of mortality have all been reasons to have a child. But that doesn't give them any more emotional or psychological validity. Like those who have children to give their lives purpose, mothers concerned with legacy see children as extensions of themselves and, as reported by many daughters, put enormous pressure on their children to reflect well on them. In this scenario, what the children want, and for that matter, what they feel and think, are largely ignored. As one daughter told me, "It was hugely important to my mother that I be admired, so that she could be admired by others for having raised me. She picked my clothes, my friends, even the college I went to, based on how enviable it would seem to her social circle. I became a lawyer because she wanted me to. When I finally realized I hated practicing law, my mother freaked out, especially when I went from this high-paying, prestigious profession to, in her opinion, the lowly work of teaching in public school. She mentions it constantly and belittles me for my choices. To keep your marriage together, or to get someone to marry you in the first place. Despite all the articles in the popular press, all the studies, and all the cautionary tales presented in novels and movies, people still appear to believe that a baby can heal a relationship already under stress. Of course, nothing could be farther from the truth, and while disagreements over child-rearing aren't among the top three reasons people divorce, those remain infidelity, drug or alcohol abuse, and money, they are extremely common. Here's the thing. Just as lovers wrongly believe they'll simply smooth over disagreements about money, couples tend not to discuss their views about raising children ahead of time. The good news, of course, is that your original motivation for having a child need not dictate how you parent if you are willing to be honest with yourself and work hard at seeing how your unconscious, unarticulated, and unacknowledged needs, not your child's, are influencing your behavior. With awareness, we become better mothers. Making the decision, yes or no. Having a child was very important to me, and I went on to have three. Yes, I was nervous, but I was also determined to have my kids be loved in all the ways I wasn't. Was I a perfect mother? No, far from it. But my children thrived, and I showered them with love, affection, understanding, and support. Everything I was denied myself. Lorraine, 48. I didn't trust myself enough to bring a child into the world. I was panicked about visiting the same misery my mother had rained on me. I was particularly scared of having a girl, and maybe, if there'd been a way of guaranteeing I would only have a son, I might have gotten up the courage. My mother was fine with my brothers, her sons. Do I have regrets now? Yes, because I am different than I was 20 years ago, and now it's too late. Deirdre, 46. While the question of whether they'll mother well is what haunts many daughters, if they're aware of how they were wounded, they already have the requisite consciousness not to repeat their mother's behaviors. If they decide to become parents, these women actually become good ones, with practice and effort. Alas, the daughters who still normalize their childhood experiences and really don't see the connection between childhood and their own deep-rooted unhappiness are most at risk for repeating their mother's behaviors, at least until they grow more aware. Eleanor, now 59, recounts how she thought a baby would fix everything, and how she really didn't think about the decision much at all. She was 19 when she had her first child. Her children are now 38 and 36. Both have failed to thrive in various ways, and she is loaded with regrets. Now that I understand how emotionally neglected I was, I understand that I didn't have the tools to be a good mother. I've talked to my children about it, but my guilt is huge. I feel I did them a disservice by bringing them into my shambles of a world. When I asked her what advice she'd give to other women, she wrote, "Deal with your own demons first. Remember, it's not just a baby. It's a human being you're responsible for. Realize that you will need a village, whether it be your partner, close friends, or family. Don't expect children to fill up the hole in your soul." If I'd been self-aware enough to realize I'd been emotionally neglected and the life consequences, I don't think I would have had children. Lisbeth, a 43-year-old professional, is childless by choice. But the question was one she struggled with her whole life. She's felt the burden of societal expectations keenly, but long wondered about her own maternal capabilities. I remember babysitting girls and watching my friends' younger siblings play with their dolls and all the nurturing behavior they play-acted. I never knew what to do with my dolls except to display them, sitting on my bed. By the time she was 10, she figured she was different somehow and started telling her friends she'd never have kids. But of course, it wasn't as cut and dry as all that. Her own recognition of how she was neglected and emotionally abused in childhood was slow in coming. Perhaps, if it hadn't taken me almost 40 years to recognize how I'd been affected, I might have started the healing process sooner, and that might have led to a different choice and outcome. Instead, she married a narcissist who treated her as her parents did, and it was only escaping that marriage and going into therapy that permitted her to see the patterns in her childhood. Still, when she reached the age of 40, what her doctor called the outside limit, she and her second husband once again talked about whether to have a child. And once again, she chose not to, with her husband's full support, despite his contention that she would make an excellent mother. As to regrets, this is how Lisbeth answers. "I do think it's the right choice for me, despite it being an unpopular one in society. I don't feel like I have a hole in my heart by not having them. I know, too, that if I ever feel I am missing out by not having them, we have the option to adopt. I strongly believe that there are many kids that need good homes if I ever want to take on that challenge." Another woman and her husband, both with distinctly negative childhood experiences, immersed themselves in parenting classes and read up on child development for 6 years before they finally felt that each of them was ready. All these years later, they are the parents of 2 young adult women and satisfied that their children were well loved, supported, and tended to. Other women report changes of heart over the years. One confided that, by the age of 14, she knew she didn't want a child, and during her 20s actually consulted several doctors about having a tubal litigation. They all refused her. But by the end of her 20s, she'd changed her mind and describes her daughter's birth as the moment I was born, and she became the mother I wanted and needed. For some women, having a child feels like an opportunity to right the wrongs of the past and to become proactive about shaping the future. Everyone's story is different, and the decision whether or not to become a mother is highly personal, even now when it's no longer considered a stigma not to have children. Indeed, many women and men live very happily without them. What unloved daughters need to remember is that much of one's success as a parent has to do with being emotionally present, no longer burdened by the automatic responses and emotional baggage of the past. That's what permits us to hew what Daniel Siegel and Mary Hartzell call the high road in their book, Parenting from the Inside Out, arguably the best book on the subject ever written. When you're on the high road, you're very aware of the emotional baggage you have in tow and what triggers your own worst responses. You work at being present and rational, committing yourself to thinking things through rather than being reactive. High road processing tends to present different possible responses to a situation and keeps you in the driver's seat. Imagine that your child suddenly starts crying when you're in the middle of something you need to get done, and it's irritating you. You register your feelings of annoyance, push them away, and then think, I need to find out why she's crying. I have to stop what I'm doing and spend a few minutes helping her calm down. High road processing effectively invites your best self in as your child's parent. Then there's low road processing, which has you forget about your emotional baggage and become a quivering mass of emotional reactivity the second your kid starts crying because, damn it, you have stuff to get done. Low road processing hijacks your conscious thought process and ability to be empathic. You just let whatever you're feeling rip, either yelling at her to stop or screaming, go to your room now. If you don't stop crying, I'll give you something to cry about. By confronting your past experiences and listening to this book, you've already committed to being on the high road. That's a fine start. Whether you decide to have a child or children, are already a mother or not. Rebuilding, breaking old patterns and learning new ones. As you begin to move in new directions, you will need to continue to hone your emotional intelligence skill set. If you are still having trouble identifying what you're feeling, most particularly in times of stress, you need to refocus, using your journal to explore what's going on. If you've become more adept at naming your feelings, the next step is to begin using them to inform your thoughts when you're making a decision or choice. This may feel uncomfortable at first, making you wonder whether you can really trust your perceptions, but just keep pushing through. It takes time to become comfortable with being in command of yourself. It's new, after all. Start using your emotional intelligence to fact-check whether the direction you're heading in is the right one and whether the goals you are setting will make you happier and feel more fulfilled. Among the questions you might want to ask yourself are, is the hesitation or anxiety I'm feeling a function of unfamiliarity, I'm trying something new, or am I reacting because I've fallen back into old patterns of behavior? Am I able to manage my emotions and reactivity as I set new goals, or do I need to refocus on self-regulating? When I get frustrated or experience a setback, do I revert to the self-critical tape, or am I able to use self-talk and compassion to get myself going again? Am I creating a support system for myself during this period of redirection? Am I letting close others in, or am I acting in old, familiar ways? Finding your best self. Perhaps the hardest part of this journey is figuring out who you want to be when your best self shows up, or when you finally are a grown-up, out from under your mother's influence. While I genuinely hate all that what doesn't kill you makes you stronger stuff, and I'm always quick to say that I would trade everything I learned in childhood for a loving and supportive mother, there are some aspects of self that are forged in positive ways. You might not have seen them before since they were buried under the muck of unhappiness and unhealthy patterns, but they are there, along with the bad stuff you have to get rid of. As you work toward redirecting your life, hold on to the pieces of yourself you actually like, and have the guts to imagine yourself as you always wanted to be. Why not? You have the tools. In the next chapter, we'll be looking at what it means to heal and why recovery is an ongoing process that takes time. Chapter 9, Recovery and Works in Progress. When will it stop hurting? Will it ever stop hurting? Annie, 53. Many daughters, and I include myself in that number, stumble over the word healing, which means to make whole or sound, free of injury or ailment. The word raises expectations that are difficult to realize. Why is the healing so slow, so unreliable? One woman emails me. I think I'm over it, and then something triggers my feelings, and I am so not over it. I've had no contact with my mother for 3 years, another writes, and while it's certainly better being free of her, I'm still hurting. Another remarks that, I'm still so sad after 5 years. Will the sadness ever end? Redefining healing. The idea of wholeness restored spurs on the kind of magical thinking that many unloved daughters indulge in, beginning in childhood when they fantasize that their real mothers will show up to reclaim them, as I did. This may include hoping for that moment when everything suddenly changes and they are embraced by their mothers fully and completely with love, and nothing needs fixing. Daughters sometimes think that it's only then that they will be made whole, and, alas, that is unlikely to happen, and even if it did, they'd still have to heal from their experiences. But perhaps it's not just about expectations and magical thinking. Perhaps the larger problem is how we think of healing and wholeness. That brings me to the Japanese art of kintsugi, which takes a very different view of things that are broken or cracked than we do in the West. When something precious is damaged, whether it's Rembrandt's The Night Watch, Michelangelo's David, or a family heirloom, we do what we can to restore it to its former pristine beauty. We want the repairs to be seamless, the cracks or slashes unseen, the object to be fully made whole so that, to all appearances, nothing untoward ever happened to it. Kintsugi takes a very different approach, one which we can apply to healing. The term means gold joinery, and the technique is used to repair ceramic objects, using lacquer and a precious metal such as gold to join the broken pieces together. It's said to date from the 15th century when, supposedly, a shogun sent a prized object back to China for repair, and it was returned with staples holding it together. Dissatisfied, the shogun sent a challenge for artisans to come up with a more aesthetically pleasing way of repair, and kintsugi was the answer. In time, these repaired objects became venerated because the visibility of their cracks and breaks testified to their history, making them emblems of resilience, the passage of time, the inevitability of change, and the possibility of transformation. It's the transformative nature of kintsugi that's so arresting because by flaunting the object's history, the object becomes more than it was before it was damaged. It becomes a new object that is part of the present, but also testifies to its past identity. I think that the way we think and talk about healing isn't productive. We expect our recovery to render us as whole as someone who was well-loved and tended to, which, frankly, isn't possible. This kind of expectation fuels our impatience with ourselves when our wounds are reopened by an event or experience, or when we disappoint ourselves and act out in those old, familiar patterns. It encourages us to stay self-critical. It makes us feel that we are less than those who had loving beginnings, forever scarred and needy. It makes us wonder who we might have been if we'd had a loving mother, and makes us think that who we are is necessarily inferior and flawed compared to those who were loved. Instead, I suggest that when we talk of healing the wounds of childhood, we bring to mind the image of a beautiful cup or bowl repaired by kintsugi, its cracks and breaks made into shining patterns of great beauty and oneness. That image may help us focus on how our past experiences inform those in the present to better see how the behaviors we adopted in childhood to cope may animate our behaviors and choices now, even as we move away from the past. As a layperson and fellow traveler, not a day goes by that I don't appreciate how my childhood, even now, shapes the woman I am in ways both seen and unseen, good and bad. Rather than seeing them as scars, envisioning those wounds as brooks, streams, and rivers of gold, silver, or copper, brings a smile to my face. As to filling the hole in your heart, the truth is that by changing your behaviors and focus, by bringing more light to bear on your experiences, you change both your perspective and the size of the hole. I don't believe that hole can ever be fully filled in. I expect that I'll be able to see the hole for as long as I live. But I can testify